the vault of startling monster horror tales of terror.
This is the Chris Keeper in the Horror Vault Express, and I'm talking to anyone who's listening out there. Just take the old Chris Keeper's advice on a dark and stormy night, alright? Alright, when some wild-eyed 8-foot maniac grabs your neck and taps the back of your favorite head on a barroom wall and looks you straight in the eye and asks you if you've paid your dues, you just stare that big sucker right back, and then you remember what the old Chris Keeper says at a time like that. Have you paid your dues, jerk? Yes, sir. The check is in the mail. On long hauls like this, I often get bored, so I just prop my old handy-dandy portable DVD player up on the dashboard here and watch a movie. So join myself, Luke Giaconetti, and the Hair Metal Hero as we watch Big Trouble in Little China. And keep my eye on the road.
All right, we are back, and this is kind of a first on the show. This is our first non-horror show, really, because I don't know if I would classify this movie as horror at all. It has elements of horror in it, but it's a John Carpenter movie, so... And, of course, I'm talking about Big Trouble in Little China. And I am here. I am Chris Honeywell. I am here with the Hair Metal Hero, Chris Tyler.
Yo.
And El Jacone, Luke Giaconetti.
No, I mean Black Blood of the Earth.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last show when we did They Live, I think I pretty much declared that my favorite John Carpenter movie, and now I just don't know. I just don't know. Because I watched this again last night, and I was just having, I was laughing out. I've seen this movie a dozen times, and I'm laughing out loud through the whole thing. I was just, it's just a treat. So I don't know. This is just a wonderful movie.
It's huge really blood.
I started jotting down catchphrases and great lines, and then I just had to stop, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Although I think my favorite is, "Are you crazy? Is that the problem?" And I've always wanted to use, "Sorry, just thrilled to be alive," I guess.
No, I don't remember the last time I had watched Big Trouble before watching it for this episode, and it was amazing how it all came back to me as soon as I started watching it. Just this is a movie that you remember it being funny, but you don't remember that it really is a John Carpenter take. One of my notes here, I said, fast like a Shaw Brothers movie. This is really John Carpenter's take on a Shaw Brothers kung fu movie.
Yeah.
All that entails, and you forget some of the more, straight elements when you haven't seen it in a while. It's like, wow, this really works as a kung fu movie, you know?
Before the kung fu movies came back into the popular culture here, too, I mean...
This is an old school one. This isn't, this isn't like one of those post Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon films where it's all wire work and the fancy schmancy stuff. This is old school 70s style kung fu. You know,
it's got some wire work in it, but it's not the same kind. It's old school wire work.
It doesn't call attention to itself like the modern stuff does.
Right.
You know,
right.
When the storms jump and throw the knives, that's the kind of scene you would have found in a Mandarin Chinese kung fu film. It's not something that's like, ooh, look at the wires. It's like, no, they got to jump, so we use wires.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Well, what I like is Kurt Russell even said it, at one point, he's like, and then there were guys coming down on wires, you know. But I mean, growing up in Jerkwater, New York, where there was no culture at all, you know, outside of just, you know, whatever you saw on TV. And when cable did, like, I could every once in a while catch a kung fu movie at my grandfather's on cable or stuff, but I didn't know enough about it to know the tropes of it outside of just, like, you know, the bad dubbing and the cut frames to make things move faster and stuff like that. But... And you know, I had, it would probably be a decade after this movie, or close to a decade, before I would even hear a Jackie Chan. Well, no, probably like 6 or 7 years before I'd even hear, know who Jackie Chan was. So I didn't even know what this was, you know, a tribute to. I just knew that it was just, the action was over the top. I could tell that it there were, that it, you know, was based on kung fu movies, but it had that extra layer of budget and great acting and hilarious screenplay that made it just, you know, like nothing I'd ever seen before. This was literally a movie that I, you know, we were in the movie theater and I saw Big Trouble in Little China and it said John Carpenter on the poster. And I said, this is what we're going to see. We had no idea what we were going to see. So I said, we got to see this movie. Everybody dragged their feet and was like, I don't know. It sounds stupid. You know, what is this? Whatever. And we all went and sat, and I remember this like it was yesterday. It was, I was probably a senior in high school. We all sat down and, the opening scene is very dry, you know, in the, you know, where they're questioning Egg. I love it, Egg. And you know, and then at the end he takes out the Jedi, you know, the Sith force lightning between his hands, and all of my friends were just like, oh yeah. And they're like, what kind of movie is this gonna be?
And that, you know, what's funny is that prologue was added because there was concern. We're going to talk a lot this show about the nebulous evil force known as the studio. And the studio was concerned that people wouldn't get what the movie was about. And they wouldn't get Jack Burton, which is why that prologue was put in. It was one of the last things shot was the prologue with Egg in the attorney's office. And it was just an idea, just a setup that, you know, try and give some kind of concept that magic is real and that Jack really is a hero, despite, you know, all the evidence to the contrary.
Right, despite everything he says and does.
It's like, Jack is the toughest buffoon in the world, I swear.
Yes. He is the action hero and the hugest dork at the same time. I love Kurt. You know, this movie would not have worked without this group of I think that he just got this magical group of actors. You know, and Kurt Russell said, what am I going to do? I don't know if he talked to Carpenter about it or if there was any sort of talk about it, but he just does the, like, channeling John Wayne.
Yeah, John Wayne.
He's doing, like, a dorky guy who loves John Wayne and is emulating John Wayne, but there's a bit, I mean, his delivery is all John Wayne.
Yeah.
But you look at his outfits and stuff and, like, you know, it's like when he's trying to pick up Gracie in the airport. He's a total, you know. If I was in the airport, I've seen many guys like that in bus stations, in Greyhound stations.
And, you know, well, he's a truck driver for crying out loud.
Yeah, yeah, and she's like, from down here, it's Miller time, you know.
You know what I say when it's Miller time.
And
you know, what's funny about talking about that his delivery is all John Wayne is that the original screenplay for Big Trouble in Little China before John Carpenter was brought in was actually a Western. It was set in the Wild West era, like the 1870s or so in San Francisco. And, you know, so it was really the, like Akira Kurosawa always called his films Easterns.
Uh-huh.
This was kind of an East meets Western originally. And again, the studio, quite rightfully, I think that it would be too many layers of separation because you're asking people to watch a Western in a time when Westerns were kind of cinema non grata in Hollywood mid-80s, and then you're going to put Chinese mysticism and Kung Fu on top of it, and it kind of would have been a little jumbled. Whereas here, we're being thrown into the modern day. It's something we can all can relate to. And then it's only that one layer of separation, which I think works in the film's benefit.
Oh yeah. Yeah! Oh, for sure.
Would have been interesting the other way, but I don't know. There's something about the big bad truck driver, so-called big bad truck driver.
Well, they could have done it like they approached the Dusk Till Dawn movies. They could do a prequel with Lo Pan in the in the Western, you know, in the early, you know, before just before the turn of the century, maybe, or something like that.
And Kurt Russell could play an ancestor of Jack Burton. He could play like Cornelius Burton.
That's true. And I mean, it's totally said in the movie that the Egg and Lopan have tangled many times before in, you know, maybe various incarnations of Egg. But yeah, so that could totally be done. I just wonder how this never became... This could have totally become a series of Jack Burton movies, you know?
I'll tell you why. Way ahead of its time.
Yeah.
Completely.
When this came out, this was like a punchline. It did so poorly, and it's like, you know...
Really?
And this was like right there with like Howard the Duck for financial disasters. and the way that it was treated in the media. This film, like it was, like I said, it's not like... like They Live or some of the other films we've talked about where they didn't do great, but maybe they got, you know, some good critical response and had their fans. This movie did terrible at the box office and got just blasted by the critics. And you look back on it now, and it's like the things they're complaining about, it's exactly like Hero, like you just said. It was before its time.
If
this movie comes out
10
years later, everybody gets it.
Yeah. I mean, literally, the dialogue in this at some points is so terrible, especially with like Gracie and Margot Litzenberger when they first make their appearance. Their exposition is so hilariously obviously badly scripted exposition, you know. They're talking in all they use every single, you know, catchphrase that a cub reporter would use, you know, that the spunky female heroine would do, and it could have been really stupid, but they played it straight. And then they add all the little touches that put depth to their character that make you, you know, make all those lines work. I just don't understand how a critic could. I mean, I went there with a group of my friends, and some of them were just like, you know, if it wasn't, you know, your normal like comedy or action movie, they were just not into it. And this was a full house in Watertown, which wasn't, you know, there were almost always full houses on the weekends because everybody would just go to the movies. And it was a full house, and that theater was going nuts. People were going nuts. They loved it, you know, laughing and cheering and you know, laughing at it, laughing with it, you know, just caught up in it, you know. It's one of the greatest film experiences that I remember, you know, of sitting in a theater and having a movie work an audience, you know. And it just blows my mind that it would have lost money and been... I don't remember it getting any of the criticism at all, because we walked into the movie theater and I hadn't heard anything about it. I hadn't heard John Carpenter had a new movie coming, didn't know what it was about, nothing. We had nothing to go on for it. And I have another friend who has tried to watch this movie like 5 times with me. He falls asleep every time.
Really?
In the first half hour, 45 minutes, he's laughing his ass off going, I can't believe I fall asleep at this movie every time. This is amazing. This is amazing. And he's laughing, you know, tears running down his face. He's never made it all the way through this movie. I can't understand it. There must be a sound wave or something in it that maybe puts him to sleep.
I can't imagine falling asleep and not seeing, you know, floating eyeballs and people blowing up. And I can't imagine.
Spider crab bug guy that eats the guy when they're underground. I love that thing.
Yeah, it just sticks
in the guy, and he's never seen again.
You will come out no more.
What will come out no more? That's just awesome. Yeah, it's literally, and I mean, and that creature, I don't know what movie it was, but there was some movie where there was moon monsters like that were literally like that. They were literally like a puppet on the end of on some sort of roller thing that comes popping out of a hole, grabs somebody by the head and pulls them in. But that was the thing about that movie. All you had to do is wait about 2 minutes and something new would pop up that you'd be like, you gotta be kidding me. And, you know, by the end of it, when the little, you know, the guy with all the eyes on him shows up and, you know, they look at it, they're like, you gotta be kidding me. You know, it's just...
And that's what they say.
Yeah, exactly. It's every few minutes in this movie, there's a new surprise. It takes a new direction that you're never gonna, you know, anticipate. It's just brilliant.
And what works is that because Jack is, you know, this is all bizarre to him too.
Yeah.
So we identify him because, you know, I just want my truck back. And what actually one of my favorite bits in this is that, you know, after the scene in the alley with the storms, you know, what do we see? We see him calling the insurance company trying to get his truck claimed, you know, and he keeps talking about his truck. And then after about the half an hour mark, we don't hear about the truck anymore until we see it. My truck!
Yep.
Yeah.
And you just laugh. It's like...
Well, that scene in the alley in the beginning... Holy cow. That's just such a well-directed action. It starts off with so much tension, you know, that with, you know, when they're just sort of looking out through the rearview mirrors and, you know, and then I just can't help but every time I see it, I'm back in the theater watching that with my friends and they're like, ooh, this is an intense fight scene. And then, then the storms come dropping out of the sky, and you know, but at that point it could have been just a regular action movie, but you start getting the idea that it's going to be, you know, over the top fun. But there's moments in it like when after Lopan zaps Kurt Russell and blinds him, and they run around a couple corners and he splashes water in his eyes and he can see again, and then they go back. And just the way, you know, they come around the corner and then you see the battle is just in, you know, has been going on. There's a lot more bodies on the ground and there's sort of smoke in the air. That scene just is very realistic and in some ways, and not very theatrical. There's just moments of that in this movie of like the mundane... all of a sudden superimposed with the supernatural and a matter of fact and comedic sort of way that you just never had seen before.
And that's something I think Carpenter has excelled at in most of his films, is that, it's hard to believe the outrageous or the fantastic if it's not based in the mundane.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, this film shows us mundanity. It's not, he's a truck driver and he's, you know, driving the Pork Chop Express, hauling a load of pigs to Chinatown, and he's, you know, got his buddy there and he's a truck driver and I gotta do this guy a favor. It's mundane stuff. There's nothing, you know, exceptionally exciting about a truck driver, you know.
Yeah, and when you hear his, and when he's talking on his radio...
Yeah.
It's just the most lame stuff in the world, you know? It's just.
What are you talking about? This shit is great.
Yeah. Oh, it's great as far as entertainment value. But if you were in another truck and you were on like hour four of the, you know, of his monologue, you might be just like, all right, man.
No, it would keep me awake. I wouldn't need the no-dos. I'd be hooked on Jack Burton keeping me up and keeping me from crashing.
Yeah, I love it. And I just love, he'd talk and then take a pause and then all of a sudden a big hoagie would come up and just like,
Yeah, I guess if you're a trucker, you're going to have sandwiches and fruit pies.
Yeah, that's right. He has a Hostess fruit pie at one point.
I can vouch for the awesomeness of those. I've eaten a few.
Oh, I love those things. It's all about the crust. It's all about the flaky crust. You know that shit's good because you see all the
supervillains.
Right, you see all the supervillains trying to steal it all the time, so you know that shit's good.
I mean, I don't understand why the Taskmaster didn't keep that shit on his belt, but, you know. But, you know, Chris, you had mentioned earlier about you didn't know some of the origins for how Jack behaved the way he did. I believe that it was Carpenter's idea to kind of do a twist on, it's kind of an American cliche and an American-made kung fu movie that, actually in a lot of genres traditionally, that, you know, the one white guy has to help out all the other colored guys. You know, whether it's in Africa or South America or China or whatever.
Yes, the white guy shows up and saves the day.
Right, whereas here, the white guy thinks he's the hero, but he's really the sidekick.
And
the hero is
Wang, I think.
Wang, he's shown to be competent, he's brave, you know, every fight he's in, he holds his own or wins. And it's like, Jack keeps thinking, this is my story, but it's not.
To be fair, he is the one who dispatches one David Lopan at the end of the film.
That's the beautiful part of it, though. That's the awesome thing is...
Because they set it up at the beginning with the bottle.
Yep.
You're right! It's all about the reflexes. And, But you know, if this was just your normal cliche movie of that, it would be Egg Shen that kills him, you know, because they've been, you know, nemesis, you know, forever, fighting forever. You have the whole scene with the ancient warriors battling through their magic. But that scene where Jack Burton kills him in the movie theater was just like, literally the place exploded after that. The people were jumping up in the air and just screaming. It was...
But he still remains Jack Burton because he's got Gracie's lipstick all over his face while he does it.
And then, oh my god. There's just so many things to... Another thing I noticed this time that I noticed before, but I didn't notice how well it played out with the actors, was once they drink his Egg Shen's potion,
they're all
which
smiling.
Egg Shen's been waiting forever. He's been dying to give people the Egg Shen. I love the character of Egg Shen. I love every character in this. Every character is such a stereotype. But at the same time, so well fleshed.
Eddie's not a stereotype. Eddie's the man.
Wait, no, no.
He's got probably my favorite line in the movie, though. When Mago says, "I must be so monumentally naive." You are.
Well, he's got the face. He's got a great mug on him, you know? He's just got that.
And a whole lot more.
He's got that whole, like, lantern jaw sort of thing going. But I love it. He plays, you know, I mean, one character's name, everybody's got fucking weird names. David Lopan, isn't it? I love it. And Kurt Russell keeps calling him Dave. And all this stuff has been, like, a lot of this kind of humor has found its way into movies since. But the scene where old man Lopan comes out at first and, you know, and just goes into that rant of like, you know what, this really pisses me off, you know.
I think it was trying to piss me off.
Yeah, that the audience went nuts during that too. That was a huge, huge laugh in the theater back in the day. And you know, that joke of the old person swear, or the old, you know, Chinese, or the person who's supposed to be sort of mystical and, you know, sort of going into a more just sort of mundane rant has been played a lot since then, but it was fresh. And there was, I mean, just about everything is still fresh in this, you know?
And what's amazing is that this is like probably the greatest collection of Asian character actors in the world. Every Asian character actor you know is in this movie.
Yeah.
And you're just picking them out. It's like, oh, it's that guy from that one, and that guy from that one.
Oh, it's the thug from Die Hard in another movie.
Yeah. That guy's been in a lot of movies. That guy's like
The Weapon, Die Hard. He has been in everything.
He's like the go-to Asian, like Will Sampson used to be the go-to American Indian character actor. Yep. You know,
and then of course the whole cast is anchored by, in my opinion, the greatest character actor of all time, in Kurt Russell. Mm-hmm. And really, what is Kurt Russell but a character actor with leading man looks?
Yes. Yes,
you know he looks. I mean, Kurt Russell. I mean, I'm happily married, secure in my masculinity, man. Kurt Russell's a good-looking guy.
Yes, he is.
But he's a character actor. Every role he plays is a character role.
Well, he comes from he comes from that Disney history, you know, of where when he was coming up, you learn to sing and dance and do comedy and do drama and do everything. So he's, and I mean, he's just a, I mean, you know, and the thing, he's just perfect as a as an action star in there. But boy, his, I think his true gift is comedy, because he's got that comic timing.
Yeah.
That's just wonderful. If anybody, have you ever seen Used Cars?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a long
time ago. He's also very funny playing a similar buffoon in the film Sky High.
Oh, Sky High is great.
In Sky High, he plays a superhero called the Commander, and he is just a glorious ignoramus. It is. Actually, what's funny is that he wears, in the scene when he goes in, goes into the brothel, he wears the glasses.
Uh-huh.
I believe this is a throwback, because I want to say in, because you had mentioned that he started out working for Disney, and he made three films for Disney as a young man, which were The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes, Now You See Him, Now You Don't, and The Strongest Man in the World. And I want to say in The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes, he wore the glasses exactly like that. So I think that might actually be a throwback to that.
A little bit of a callback to that.
Which is then funny, because in Sky High, in his civilian identity, he wears glasses again as a callback to The Computer Wore Tennis Shoes. So I could say, hey, it's the Commander.
He might have just kept those glasses and been like, hey, you want me to use my computer?
Can we talk about that brothel scene for a second?
Sure.
Because that to me is...
Chinese girls do not come with green eyes.
Green, but it's he's so over the top in that scene. And it's like, how are they not seeing through this guy?
Because everybody in this universe is over the top. Everybody is, you know.
But he's just, he goes in there and just...
Well, because he's not trying to fool him into a real John. He's going in there to stir the pot. He's in there stirring the pot. He's just in there. He's in there to say green eyes and waggle his eyebrows, so the one lady goes scuttling down, you know, to check on their captive.
Oh my god! I crack up almost everything he does in this. I crack up.
It's amazing.
When he's getting the knife out of his boot and he whips it across the room, I'm just like, how can you be so stupid?
And he manages to drive an 18-gear truck and not...
Right.
...not kill himself. I got the feeling watching it this time that it's got to be Kurt Russell spoofing himself.
To a degree, yeah. It definitely is. I mean, he was playing the leading man for so long after his Disney career that he just goes into this, and you can't not laugh at him.
It's amazing how much stuff just happens in this movie. How many incredibly juicy scene, you know, wonderful scenes there are. They don't, you know, even today where we have a shorter attention span, you rarely see a movie with this much packed in it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, there's...
Yeah, it really doesn't stop.
If you want to pick out, like, talk about his buffoonery, you could find, like, 10 examples. I mean, you can see him knocking himself out when he shoots the hole in the...
Oh, my God.
That's amazing. My wife doesn't normally watch the films with us for this show because she doesn't like horror movies, but she watched this one, and I think right about then she's like, this guy's really an idiot.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Well, when he throws the knife and then comes back and everybody's already dispatched, it's like he's the look of dejection on his face. Like, I'm getting ready to rumble here. Why didn't they wait for me?
Well, he's got his like war face on. He comes around the corner like, run!
Ah!
It's funny though. It's sometimes like I noticed that Wang in that occasion dispatches all those guys like real quickly, but when he was fighting those women, it took him a while. It was a long fight with them. It was strange that, you know, his level of fighting competence. Well, actually, after he fought those women, that's when they drank their...
They drank the potion.
And that was what I was talking about earlier, is that I never thought about the potion after the first few times I saw the movie, after the scene in the elevator where they're all just like, hey, you know, they're all buzzing and they're all just sitting there like with these great looks on their face, looking at each other, going, hey, I feel pretty good. And Jack is, of course, the dork who has to, you know, say it out loud. You know, they're all looking at each other, and he's the one who has to go, I feel pretty confident about this. As a matter of fact, you know. But
the only thing that elevator scene is missing is what is the cliche that has to be playing on the elevator music anytime somebody's in an elevator in a movie?
Girl from Ipanema.
Yeah.
Girl from Ipanema. If the girl... that would have been perfect.
Which would have been great. Yeah, it would have been perfect in this movie, yeah. And but then from that point on, everything... I was looking at everything through the lens of them being on, you know, the his magic potion, which, you know, gave them confidence and put them in, you know, closer to the spirit world or whatever. It was some sort of like mystical Chinese cocaine is what it basically seemed like. And
it was a six demon bag.
And you could see like all the actors had that in their mind that they were, you know, they're, he has this goofed out look on his face like someone who's on drugs. When he kisses Gracie, he's just wasted, and that's why he kisses her. He's just like, I'm gonna go for it because I'm on happy confidence potion.
I'm feeling pretty confident. Yeah. Actually, you had mentioned earlier that this film is just crammed full of stuff, and you'd also mentioned some of the dialogue from Gracie and such. What's funny is, way back before when we talked about The Thing, we talked about the influence of Howard Hawks on John Carpenter. Well, Gracie and Jack's dialogue, that rapid fire back and forth dialogue, uh-huh, was done specifically to evoke the Howard Hawks era of that kind of snappy banter between the male lead and the female lead. And watching it now in a movie made in the 80s, you're like, this is weird. But then you think about it and you're like, this would have been normal if this was 40 years ago.
Yeah. And then at the end, you know, aren't you going to kiss her? And he's just, nope.
I remember seeing that. When I saw that for the first time, I was like, wow.
He is the coolest guy in the world.
And that was where we were supposed to end, too. Right when he walks out. When Wang closes the door, that was supposed to be the end of the film, right there.
Oh, really?
The studio made him add the epilogue with the Shaggy Man on the truck. I don't really understand why the studio would want to add that, unless they, you know.
I know that's like just that. To me, yeah, that doesn't, it doesn't add anything. It's weird. That almost seems like kind of the stuff that usually studios want you to cut out. You know, like a little fat to cut out. That's a very strange. It doesn't, because it does. Usually they try to tack something on, like you said at the beginning, because they're afraid people aren't going to get it. You know, they're underestimating the intelligence of the viewer of it. But that scene doesn't really add anything to the story or flesh out anything.
All it does is really set up potential for a sequel.
Yes. Well, I mean, I'm all for that. I would have been all for, you know, Jack Burton and, you know, and except next time maybe it was, you know, Mexican mysticism, you know, some...
I mean, and that's, you know, really, what's this, I mean, if you look at it, what is this film in the vein of? This is to the Shaw Brothers what Raiders of the Lost Ark was to the old serials. So, yeah, you're right, a Jack Burton and the, you know, Temple of Doom, for lack of a better title, would have been something.
Awesome.
Speaking of temples, let's not discount the pretty rad set design for all the evil shenanigans. When have you ever seen a skull temple highlighted in neon?
It's
beautiful. Makes no fucking sense, but it's awesome looking.
It's awesome looking, but the thing is...
It's Chinatown, you know?
Well, that's the thing is, you know, the David Lo Pan character is kind of, you know, he's kind of Fu Manchu, basically. He's the Fu Manchu of this one. But a lot of that, you know, a lot of the way he's got it decorated in that mixture of, you know, old school and modern stuff, because he's old, but, you know, he's been living in the modern time recently. So, yeah, put some neon up there. Make it look nice. And I like how they mixed the modern, the old, the mystical, and then the just sort of dirty, mundane behind the scenes, you know, the back kitchen of a Chinese restaurant and, you know, outside the open markets and stuff like that. just all those things together just made a great atmosphere. And yeah, and once you were inside the underground, you know, the whole underground complex, I mean, it would be really interesting to try to, like, actually map it out. Because I know it's mapped out. You've got Wang, you know, Wang is mapping it out in his head the whole time. Every time they got to get there, he's always, when they're traveling, he's going, okay, we're going up and down, and now we went this way. He always seems to sort of have an idea where they're going. So, just awesome. You got the hell of the
upside down.
And
Chinese have a lot of hells.
What is it, the hell of boiling oil? Really? No, it says keep out.
He goes, you're kidding. Yes, I am.
You know what struck me is when you see Lo Pan and he's, you know, he's getting his power back at the end, all I could think of is like, Jesus, if Marvel had done Iron Man in the 80s, that was your fucking Mandarin right there.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh my God.
You know, he's got stuff coming out of his fingers and everything.
Do the Mandarin, frankly.
I'd like to see the Mandarin. Mr.
I'd love to see the Mandarin. I'm a huge Iron fan, and the Mandarin's awesome. And anyone who says the Mandarin is outdated is I'll argue that point with them. But yes, that I totally got a Mandarin vibe from Lo Pan when he's wearing his when he's in his traditional garb and he's floating around. It's like that's the Mandarin baby right there. That's why the Mandarin.
But he's got the Chinese version of the Steve Martin arrow through his head. He's got like the like hat pin like through his head decoration.
Yeah.
I love that. And what's up with his fingernail? Like his fingernail grows every time that he's going between spirit states. Just weird little details like that. They, you know, Carpenter didn't. There's just so many things that didn't need to be thrown in there that just got thrown in there. And at first, it seems like almost randomly, but the more you watch it, you know, it's just amazing. It rivals. I think of this as almost his most Spielbergian movie, you know, because of the fun, light aspect and the insane attention to detail in it.
Well, going back and looking at it now, you can probably say it's probably his most mainstream film outside of Starman overall.
Yeah, I'd say
that. Others, I mean,
there's a couple others, but not many. Not many that really shoot for kind of a big mainstream audience, you know?
And it's a little weird for mainstream, but then again, this was a time when Gremlins was coming. You know, Gremlins was all sort of just.
This you're talking 1986. So, like you said, you got Gremlins, you got Ghostbusters. You know, we had already had Temple of Doom. You know, Disney was putting out the Black Cauldron.
Yep.
You know, we were getting some things that were a little bit different. It was, you know, we were knee deep in Reagan here. Things were changing. You know, this was definitely the 80s. Like Tom Servo would say. And speaking of Tom Servo, what can we say about Kim Cattrall in this film?
She's got a really good set of contacts in.
Yeah. Which is really funny because about like a couple of days ago, my wife and I saw a commercial for some kind of skin product with Kim Cattrall on it. And I said, notice her eyes aren't green here.
Yeah. I have one thing I do not like about this movie, and I do not like it at all, and I think it's the worst example of what it is in any John Carpenter movie, and that's the song at the end. The big China song. Oh, I hate it.
Oh, I fucking love that song.
It's like the worst example. It's like all the worst aspects of bad 80s like movie songs that
maybe
have to have the name of... I get, maybe.
think about your James Bond film, okay? They really shoehorned some suckers in there over the years.
I know.
Lulu crooning The Man with the Golden Gun.
I like that one.
I like that one too, but I've always been a little partial against it because you know who originally was supposed to do the title for The Man with the Golden Gun? With Alice Cooper.
Oh, really?
That's right, yes.
And the Coop actually released a song called The Man with the Golden Gun. And if you listen to it, yeah, it's supposed to be, it's the same length as the Lulu song. It has, you know, it makes references to the Golden Gun and all that. It's really supposed to be the James Bond title theme, because what happened is, in 1973, Wings did Live and Let Die, and the song was very popular. So Saltzman and Broccoli said, well, let's get another rock and roll act. And so whatever label that they were working with, Alice Cooper was signed to, they said, look at Alice Cooper, you know, you don't get much more rock and roll than him. And they were, you know, this was 74, so they're a little concerned about the coupe, you know, that he might turn some people off. So we got Lulu instead. But again, getting back to the point, but yeah, you know, I like the song, but I'm not putting it on the MP3 player or anything, but I think it was intentionally kind of bad. Like, you know, that same kind of really earnestly trying and just, you know, shooting the masonry above your head sort of situation.
Well, you know, it just had, there was that, and John Carpenter uses it in an instrumental way in a lot of his things, you know, the drum machine, drum beat and stuff. It was just the 80s generic pop sound, you know?
Yeah.
And there were a lot of movies, and there were sometimes, say, like, whatever the movie Oingo Boingo is in, you know, where they were sort of playing that stereotype, but they were Oingo Boingo, so it was a good song, you know, the song worked out, you know, in that style. But sometimes, back when I saw it in the theater, it didn't bother me at all because it sounded just sort of like end credits music at the time. But now it's just sort of like, the lyrics are pretty painful too, but not
well,
in a wonderful
wrote
way.
Them, that's why.
Huh?
If Carpenter wrote them, it's him
Did
and
he?
Nick Castle and one of the other cohorts all playing on that song.
Oh.
Yeah, that's the Coupe de Villes is his band.
Yeah.
So Carpenter plays guitar and Nick Castle plays something. I can't remember the other guy that's in it, but that's his pretty much his rock and roll outfit.
Yeah.
Well, I will say that the song notwithstanding, I thought the soundtrack to this film was really good.
Oh, yeah. It had all the elements of great John Carpenter music.
Yeah, and it's very much an action movie score in the vein of something like Escape from New York rather than a horror score. But it still has a lot of, like you say, a lot of the trademark John Carpenter sounds, and it really works well with the action that it's scoring.
And another thing I noticed this time that I just noticed is John Carpenter uses the exact same font.
Yes.
At least so far on all the films we've seen in the credits. Huh?
Yeah.
All the credits always look exactly the same.
They're all in the same font, and it's like
white
his
text
own,
on black background, yeah, same font.
I don't know what the actual font is, but it's like it's very distinctive, and he uses it on his posters too. A lot of the times they're all in that font, and I'm noticing that more because every time we do a show now, I'm photoshopping, you know, I'm going through a bunch of pictures of posters and John Carpenter stuff and photoshopping, you know, stuff, and so I'm always just seeing that font, that same font. There's a little pointiness to it that makes it stand out as the John Carpenter font, so I think I could pretty much pick out that font anywhere now if anybody
it's a little visual signature that you wouldn't think about unless you're like us and have watched, you know, six or seven John Carpenter films in a row here.
In a row, yeah.
And,
that's a great idea. I mean,
apparently it's Albertus MT. That's the font. Now we know.
What was the first name of it there?
Albertus, Albertus MT.
I gotta see if I have that font. I might have to start using the John Carpenter font now.
You know, one thing that's interesting, when you look at the time that this film came out, and then, of course, you compare it to when it started kind of gaining its cult notoriety. You know, it came out in 1986, and I'd say by the mid-90s or so, you know, people started remembering Big Trouble in Little China as this awesome little action movie. But what's funny to me is if you look at some other kung fu properties that came out after it, that the influence that it had, whether consciously or subconsciously on some of them, and the one that sticks out to me is Mortal Kombat. A lot of elements of Mortal Kombat can be traced back to Big Trouble in Little China. And, you know, the most obvious, of course, being Raiden, being the thunder god with the straw hat.
Yes.
Shooting the lightning bolts. It's like, I looked at that, it's like, oh, it's like thunder from Big Trouble in Little China. And, you know, and you've got the goofball, mega macho hero in Johnny Cage. He's a little bit more, you know, a little bit more competent than Jack Burton is, but and then you've got the, you know, the super serious Asian hero in Liu Kang, take me back to Wang, and you've got Shang Tung wearing his robes with the magic powers like Lo Pan. You know, there's a lot of little things like that. They're kind of generic cliches, but they're done in a way that's like, this has got to be a callback to the Big Trouble.
Yeah, I know Raiden for a fact was, that's where I definitely got the idea from.
What's funny also is some other fighting games you don't necessarily think of. There was a fighting game series by SNK called Art of Fighting, which originally was set in the 1970s. And then they later, because of King of Fighters, they had to move it up. It's all very, very convoluted. But there's, you know, King of Fighters has a lot of elements in it also that's kind of connected. Like, for instance, there's one character who is a... He's a biker, but also I think he's a truck driver. His name is Jack Turner. And he's a big, burly guy with a mullet, and he every time he tries to say something, he screws it up.
Like sounds about says, right, yeah.
Like he tries to strike, he'll, like one of his intros in Art of Fighting 2, he says, oh, what bone do you want me to rip off you first, your arm or your leg? And his opponent's like, it's limb, you idiot, not bone. So I always, you know, I always thought that Jack Turner... The name is so close, it's got to be kind of a play on Jack Burton a little bit.
Another line I just remembered. Relax, everybody. I'm here. Love that line. I might have to just start using that in my regular life whenever I enter a room. Relax, everybody.
my friend Bob, who I've talked about in this show before, who's a professional wrestler, a bit he would use if he was in, you know, if he was in a match and was using a weapon, after he hit the guy with the weapon, he would turn to the crowd and say, don't worry, I'm okay.
Nice.
Yeah, you know, this movie could have used a little wrestling in it. That's about the only thing it didn't have in it. I guess he was saving that.
Yeah, you need like a little Highlander bit where they end up at a wrestling match. A little like the PSAs and the Fabulous Freebirds thrown in for good measure.
And it was great when I was I have actually gotten to visit San Francisco a couple times and go to Chinatown, and both times I did go walk around going, can we go in alleys and see if we can find some Wing Kong? Or there you go. You know, you would think, you know, I was expecting around every corner seeing like little skinny guys with the sunglasses with the little slits in them, and it's just like, there they are, the Yuzuka. They're everywhere here.
Well, that's like going to Little Italy in New York and expecting somebody to get shot and drop oranges across the street, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, God, I just keep remembering, and that whole scene in the airport, and when they throw her in the back of their car, and they're driving out of the parking garage, and Jack's got to throw Wang out in front of, I mean, it's just got a little bit of every kind of movie in it, you know, it just doesn't stop. That's a total, you know, car chase scene with weird, you know, that weird shot where she's in the very back of the car, and the camera's sort of looking at her, and you see up through the rear window.
They're driving a Trans Am, right? That's about the only place you'd fit.
Right.
Three of them.
But it's like it's just so, you know, even the style of filming changes as the atmosphere changes in this, you know, movie, until, you know, once you're in Lo Pan's residence, it's a, you know, a more formal style, you know, traditional style of filmmaking. But you know, before that, there's a lot of action and quick cuts and stuff, and... Man, I'm almost ready to go watch it again tonight.
You know, you mentioned the three punks kidnapping the girl, and then in the Trans Am. Is it bad that makes me think of the two brothers who raced John Cusack from Better Off Dead.
Oh, right.
More we meet on the field of battle.
Jesus, I'm never going to be able to watch that the same way again now.
Oh, man. Well, I'm not, you know, I'm always going to crack up now whenever I hear the line, you know, pray your cards right, and you may have to talk about it.
Pray your cards right, live to talk about it.
Yeah, that joke got a double-sized laugh when I watched it last night since, you know, our outro of last month's show.
Perhaps I can help you.
I crack up every time he opens his mouth. Yeah, because he's got sort of his... I just wish they would have put a little more, because he's got a little bit of the what Bruce Lee going on there, except for the, you know, the W's.
Yeah.
But
he takes Mr. Lopan's death very, very hard.
Yeah. Yes.
Really tore him up inside.
That what a wonderful special effect that is. I love it. I love it. And, you know, you're watching the movie, it's chase, supernatural, you're thinking, you know where it's going. Then all of a sudden, Gracie's getting grabbed by a giant, and you're like, oh, now there's a giant monster, you know, that's a gorilla monster that's carrying people around. Ah.
And doesn't he carry her, like, with her completely horizontal, like the,
Oh, yeah, right, slung over his shoulder, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I was looking for color reference for a Monster on the Campus model, and I stumbled onto a site where a guy had archived pictures of every monster from every 50s B movie that was carrying a girl in his arms. Like, what? It's one of the rules of the internet. It's like, there's a fetish for it.
Yeah. And yeah, it probably was. He probably like, you know, gets in his gorilla suit with his wife every weekend and like, no, you're not doing it right. Kick your legs. No, just from the knees. No, you're not doing it right. Okay, we're gonna watch these movies again. Pay
watch
attention
Robot
this
Monster,
time.
And you're gonna get this right.
Robot Monster. Oh, what a masterpiece.
With the billion bubble machine.
Yeah. Robot Monster would be a great double feature with, I just recently found a torrent for this one too, a Schlock, better known as Banana Monster.
Oh, Schlock.
Yeah, another guy in a gorilla suit. Great movie with carrying girls around, and I love that movie so much. Someday Scott and I might do a special episode on Schlock. We've got a whole story about how we first saw that movie. Yeah, oh man. And you know what? Guaranteed nobody's going to remake this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Guaranteed it would be the most pointless exercise ever, doomed to fail. But then again, you never know what kind of dumb ideas the studio
would be getting into.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the studio, I mean, there's the one that amazes me is that there's always talk of a remake of Suspiria. If you can remake Suspiria, and you can try to remake anything if you're going to remake Suspiria. So
why would? I don't get it. I don't get it. That would just
If they do remake it, there's no way that they allow Jack Burton to be a buffoon.
No.
There's no way that happens. That's happening.
Unless they do it completely. Just completely straight comedy, you know.
Yes, yeah.
And get one of those buffoonish comedians like.
Well, I was just gonna say they're gonna get Will Ferrell to
Will
play.
Ferrell,
him
that's exactly
something.
What I was thinking. Get Will Ferrell or one of the Wilson brothers. You know,
he has to be. He has to be good looking. He still has to be a good looking dude. It's not gonna work. He's supposed to look like he's the hero.
Right. Well, the thing is. Is in the beginning of the movie, he looks doofy, but he keeps, you know, first he loses his jacket, you know, till he's just in his wife beater, you know, and then his hat, he starts looking more and more like the action hero as the movie goes on, you know, his clothes, his shirt gets ripped and stuff. But in the beginning, you know, he's got his goofy hat on, he's got his Harley Davidson hat on, and, you know, he's just sort of, you know, mullet guy.
I would like to say that Jack Burton is one of the easiest cosplays you could pull off if you went to, like, Dragon Con or something.
Yep. Just finding the t-shirt, which you can actually get now.
Just finding it, yeah, a good-looking t-shirt.
Yeah, but then it might help to look like Kurt Russell.
Yeah, but if you look like Kurt Russell, you're probably not going to Dragon Con anyway.
Well, I just don't, yeah, there's... Well, you know, I don't know, but if you look like Kurt Russell and you went to Dragon Con, just think of the play you'd be getting. It was like the guy, when we went there, there was a guy there, dead ringer for Harrison Ford. You know, he was rocking the indie outfit. And Scott and I were wondering, you know, okay, here's this guy. I mean, he's a dead ringer for Harrison Ford. I'll bet you that he's not really a really super nerdy guy. But he was thinking, you know, if I go to all these, you know, I could, because he was always chatting up whoever the least dressed lady was at the time,
yeah.
You know.
And there's a
it was usually a version of what's her name from the Fifth Element.
Oh, yeah.
Lilu.
Yes, he was usually chatting up a Lilu from the Fifth Element, but, you know.
I can't even imagine what some of the Lilus that cosplay look like.
Oh, good Lord. Oh, my God.
You don't have enough tape on, honey. Keep going.
We were at one point where there were two Lilus within 10 feet of each other, and both were being talked up by Indiana Jones. And it was really funny because the really pretty Lilu was being, you know, hit up by the guy who looked just like Harrison Ford. And her shorter, slightly dumpier one was being, you know, hit up by the slightly dumpier version of Indiana. You know, he didn't.
You know, there's a pecking order to these things.
Yeah. His hat wasn't the, you know, I mean, the Harrison Ford guy went out and bought an expensive fedora, you know, Indiana Jones fedora. You know, he went and got the authentic everything, and the other guy was like, you know, maybe he might have sewn some of the stuff himself, you know. And did it. And although I give more credit to the guys who make the stuff themselves, but that was just there weren't enough Lilus. There were only two or three Lilus, but still, that's still pretty good. I'll dig them out. I got pictures. I'll send you guys pictures, I'm sure.
Great.
If you wouldn't mind checking those out for purposes of research and.
For research purposes.
Yes. Oh, yeah, research, yes.
Yep, I'm a gifted researcher.
I do a lot of research on the internet.
But you're also a master debater, so that works.
That's
out nicely.
True. Sometimes I do both at the same time.
Not only that, he is also a cunning linguist.
So, yes. So, hey, we got big plans for next time.
I've got a big thing for Kim Cattrall. Oh!
Ooh, whoa.
I'm going to tell your wife you said that.
Well, I'm just quoting Tom Servo, so.
That's true.
And as I said the last time, it could be worse. I could be like Gypsy and have a big thing for Richard Basehart. Richard Basehart!
So what are we doing next?
Oh, it's another double feature.
Oh, double feature,
Call me
eh?
Snake.
Yeah. We're doing a double serving of Snake Plissken. So more Kurt Russell.
More Kurt Russell and more action.
Yeah, heaping on the Kurt Russell and more character actors galore.
Oh,
more
my god!
Character actors than you could shake a Chief Will Sampson at.
And Adrian Barbeau.
You got your Adrian Barbeau. You got your Ernest Borgnine. Ernest Borgnine. I actually got to use it. I have a friend of mine who she has a pug dog. And when I went to visit her, the pug and I got along. She has like six dogs, but the pug and I got along especially well. And I love pugs. And she's just like, well, what do you like about pugs? And I'm like, they all look like Ernest Borgnine. They all kind of breathe like him. They all have the same face. And I just, you know. And I was talking to her on the phone today, and I hear in the background just sort of like wheezing and stuff. And I'm like, hey, did Borgnine just pull up, you know? Hey, Snake, hop on in! Oh, boy, Snake Plissken and my cat!
Handle the computers, and you and me can handle Reinhardt! Oh, was it Tava Familia? Mine's a sea turtle. I keep him under my sweater.
Oh, boy. More
than
more
boy, you ever can name that reference.
And if anybody wants to have some Ernest Borgnine-y fun, just to tangent some more on Ernest Borgnine, there was a great cartoon series called The Ripping Friends that was done by John Crisfalucci, who did Ren and Stimpy.
Yeah, and Ren and Stimpy era.
Yes, this was probably around 2003, I think they were doing these. They're very inappropriate cartoons for Saturday morning. It was awesome. But Ernest Borgnine played a mutated wad of chewing gum in an episode called The Indigestible Wad, which actually has Ernest Borgnine saying lines like, "I am the indigestible wad! Ah, I must have moisture. I crave moisture." This is awesome. I didn't even know Borgnine was still alive, much less doing voiceovers for kitty cartoons. I was overjoyed.
Well, you heard the secret, right? That
What's
he told
that?
Larry King about how he lived so long?
No.
I'm not going to spoil it. People on the internet, get on that shit. Go on YouTube. Look for Ernest Borgnine describing to Larry King why he's been able to live so long. It's
oh,
worth the
no.
Time.
It's something obscene, isn't it?
Oh, you bet.
It's on the internet, so that's a really good bet.
All right, so that's something to look forward to.
Did you know? You can sponsor an episode of this or any other of your favorite Two True Freaks affiliated shows. That's right. Simply click the PayPal link on our website, donate any amount at all, tell us which show you're choosing and what message, if any, you'd like us to read on your behalf, and you will be an official sponsor of that show's very next episode, with your message read in the show's opener. It's that easy, and there is no minimum donation. Be a show sponsor today. Visit our website at twotruefreaks.libsyn.com. Two True Freaks is always spelled TWOTRUEFREAKS. Libsyn is spelled LIBSYN.
You can email Two True Freaks directly at twotruefreaks@gmail.com.
Join our forum at forumforgeeks.com. where you can discuss all of the shows on our feed with us and your fellow listeners.
You can find Two True Freaks on Facebook. Just search for Two True Freaks.
And hey, you can friend me, Scott Gardner, on Facebook too. My name is spelled Scott Gardner.
You can friend me on Facebook too, if you can find me.
Now available, Two True Freaks t-shirts. See our website for details.
Two True Freaks is a very proud member of the Comics Podcast Network. You can check that out at www.comicspodcast.com, where you can hear our new episodes when we put them up.
We are also members of the League of Comic Book Podcasts. For more information, visit comicbooknoise.com/league.
If you ever leave your house and you actually have friends, why don't you tell them about Two True Freaks? Thanks for listening.
And join us every Monday for new episodes of
Two True Freaks.
Attention, people of Earth. Do not resist us. All who oppose us shall be annihilated. We command the most powerful army of monsters in the universe. They are sure to defeat your Earth monsters. All those who are hearing this are now under the control of the Earth Destruction Directive.
Hey, you! Yes, you, hearing this message. Do you like podcasts? Well, evidently you do, because you're listening to one right now. Do you like giant monsters? Of course you do! Who doesn't like giant monsters? Well, then have I got the show for you. Earth Destruction Directive is the newest Daikaiju podcast on the internet. And we talk about all your old favorites, like Godzilla, Rodan, King Ghidorah, and Gamera. But also lesser-known monsters, like Gappa, Yongari, and Giyawa. We cover everything from movies to comic books to video games, and we're kicking it old school at earthdestructiondirective.blogspot.com. Check it out, won't you? And remember, the EDD has got their eyes on you!
Well, it's big and terrible. More frightening than I ever thought possible.